You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, the beginning of a very special mini-series on the films of the Brat Pack, featuring MILFs, priests, sweaty sax players, Molly Ringwald, mannequins, crackheads, bank robbers, dead dudes, Asian ladies, and 1001 voicemails. Martin.
Yes.
That's Mr. Asshole to you. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, it's Brat Girl Summer, baby!
Oh, yes.
And returning to the podcast for the first time in half a century?
Mm-hmm.
Half a decade. Half a millennium.
It's been a while.
It's Cody Bouchard.
Burr, 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 burr.
How are you, Cody?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Good, good.
Not bad. We're here to kick off a mini-series about the Brat Pack, inspired primarily by Andrew McCarthy's somewhat inexplicable doc, Bratz, which catalogs and tries to work through kind of the legacy of the 80s troupe of pop cinema actors who kind of dominated the period, starting with St. Elmo's Fire, which we'll cover tonight.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting doc because you think it'd just be about nostalgia. Because, I mean, the movies could just speak for themselves, but it ends up a lot being about this chip he has on his shoulder for how this article that named them the Brat Pack ended up ending their careers, or his career, because a lot of everyone else in the group did just fine.
Most everyone else is fine. This whole documentary is just him trying to justify why his career went to shit.
Yeah.
Well, and let's get this out of the way up front, because it's something I texted you, Martin, is that he's fine too.
Yeah.
That's the most baffling part of the documentary, is that he acts like all of these other people went on to fame, fortune, and huge, like, Tom Cruise-level careers, when, A, they didn't. They did pretty well for themselves.
Demi Moore did pretty good.
Demi Moore did, like, pretty good. But, I mean, like, Rob Lowe, they all had their moment. But, I mean, Demi Moore basically falls off the face of the earth after Striptease in, what, like, the mid-90s?
95, yeah.
Yeah, 95, 96. Mm-hmm. Rob Lowe kind of hits his peak in the early 90s and then comes back on TV with, like, Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
Judd Nelson is managing a Wendy's somewhere currently.
Wasn't he big in, like, Law and Order or SVU or something like that for a while?
I think he was on one of those. And I know that he's in, like, a string of those almost, like, straight-to-Lifetime movies that's, like, stalked by my neighbor or, like, babysitter in the basement.
Yeah, there's one where he had her, like, I remember he had her locked in, like, a cage.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of thing.
Stuff that only, like, people who end up on lists watch. So, but I mean, Andrew McCarthy, he's a television director now, and he's worked on a bunch of major series, including helming 15 episodes of Orange is the New Black, which was like a cultural sensation for a moment. So it's weird because he spends half of his own movie on camera, A, sending people voicemails. Like, there's a whole portion in the beginning where it's like, because he's almost structuring the documentary from the conception of the very idea to, like, he's like almost filming pre-production with all the voicemails he's leaving everybody, and he films them, and like nobody picks up the fucking phone.
It's like it's like the Jinx. He kind of, it's like the Jinx, but like for a Brat Pack documentary.
Yeah, you watch him brainstorm live on camera. You watch him basically leave these voicemails and essentially enter pre-production. And then he's like filming himself in interstitials, like driving to all these individuals' houses and just kind of talking to the camera the whole time. And he just seems like morose and has this, like you said, a chip on his shoulder.
100%.
But you sit there and you're like, you did okay. Like, you directed, like, episodes of Gossip Girl and shit. Like, calm the fuck down. Like, I don't understand. Like, it's almost like he saw himself.
It's because he was a New York actor, so he thinks he should have, like, a cabinet full of Tonys and Oscars.
Exactly.
That's true.
Or,
yeah.
Like, he should have been, like, a Tom Cruise, or, like, he this kind of, like, almost torpedoed his chances.
That's exactly what he thinks.
You know, and, but you sit there and you go, you did okay for yourself, man. And also, like, look at Ally Sheedy. She didn't exactly ascend to any great heights beyond the 80s.
Hey, she was in Short Circuit.
I know, but I mean, like, even that's 88?
Yeah.
So, like, and also, like, Molly Ringwald had her moment. She came back, like, a little bit there, but, like, mostly it's just a good talk show guest now and hangs out, and I think it's just a mom?
Yeah.
For the most part.
She pops up in some TV shows sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. She comes back and acts in, like, some small screen stuff, but the main thing is that even Rob Lowe, who probably had the most iconic and the longest career out of all of them, like in terms of just longevity.
Longevity, yes.
Like,
but
like
not
coming back to like Parks and Rec and stuff. And I mean, like, he even survived a Robert Downey Jr. level kind of fall from grace and scandal with all the underage girls and being on a sex tape and stuff.
Yeah.
So like, but he's, I mean, even he ends up, and most people, if you were to talk to, like, we're all in our late 30s, early 40s. If you were to talk to a bunch of people or say like a generation below us, nobody would know Rob Lowe from Bad Influence or St. Elmo's Fire. They would know him as the guy from Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
Which he even name drops in the documentary. And it's like, oh, I did really well for myself doing that. And it's like, but I guess my ultimate point is that the majority of them all ended up in the same place. TV. And that's fine. That's still, you're a working actor. You're making a living and people know who the fuck you are in their living rooms.
Yeah, the houses that we got to visit in the doc are all very beautiful houses.
Exactly. Like, nobody's living in a shack anymore. Well, we don't see where Judd Nelson's living, so I'm just assuming.
He's in a Unabomber.
Yeah,
like,
a Unabomber cabin or just a cardboard box in Reseda.
He's in, like, a ghillie suit the whole time, like, hiding in the back, just, like, pops up out of the forest behind Andrew McCarthy. It's funny because one of the points that he makes in the doc, which I get the thesis, is that calling them the Brat Pack looped them together as this like kind of inseparable whole, right? And it took them away. He said that it takes away our individuality as actors, as creators, as artists, right?
Well, and devalues the way they approach their craft.
Exactly. And again, to Cody's point, he's this guy who's like, no, I come from fucking New York, man. Like, I'm like a theater kid. I'm not just some pretty boy. But this whole group runs the gamut of like Emilio Estevez, like obviously Nepo Baby.
Yeah. Who's the one that the article was originally based after, because it was supposed to be a profile of Emilio Estevez. And the most awkward interview in the entire doc, which we'll get into more in the actual Emilio Estevez episode, is where like he's the first one that McCarthy goes and more or less like confronts in his kitchen. And Estevez is obviously so uncomfortable the entire time.
They're standing the whole time.
And he even is basically like, I don't really want to talk about this.
Yeah.
You know? Because
he must have told them there was a different premise for him coming for the visit. And they just kind of sprung this
probably
on.
Right.
It feels like an almost gotcha moment that kind of, it almost backfires and sinks the entire movie. Especially leading with that one, the way it's structured.
Yeah, it like feels like a bad reporting interview or something.
Well, you almost wonder why he didn't put the Estevez one towards the end. That almost feels like something you build towards. Like you get, like you almost do. If I were sequencing the doc and editing it,
open up with Ali.
I would almost shift and open up with like Ali Sheedy, which they have a pretty good rapport with.
She's
but
so
even
sweet.
That one's a little, it's a little janky because you can tell she's kind of placating him like a little bit.
Yeah.
But I would almost move it to where the Estevez one is like the turn into the ultimate climax. Cause you get, you know, the movie essentially ends with him confronting the writer and being like, what do you think? What were your motivations? Why the fuck did you do this?
Getting,
and the writer's pretty
schooled.
Candid about like, I didn't think this was going to be a big deal. Like I just wrote a thing and then all of a sudden I'm being asked to be on talk shows and like Phil Donahue and shit are being like the Brat Pack, the Brat Pack, the Brat Pack. And he's like, I didn't intend it that way. It was just a clever phrase that I threw in.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it just created a piece of history. So you kind of get why that's the climax. But
yeah.
I would almost
he's
put
like
the Estevez
boss.
One
yeah.
next to it because you can also tell that Estevez kind of harbors a decent amount of guilt. And he even admits to where he's like, yeah, man, like I let this guy get too close to me. And I thought, you know, I was naive and young and like, thought it like I could be friends with a reporter and just kind of hang out with them, and I fucked up essentially, and now we all had to deal with the consequence of it. But the thing that I took that's the most positive from the documentary is that, and why I wanted to do these episodes, is that these movies are actually pretty interesting, and they're kind of big moments in American pop cinema history. And where the doc actually comes alive the most is when it just becomes a more or less like a nostalgia piece and has, you know, archival footage of John Hughes talking about Pretty in Pink and looking like one of the members of Flock of Seagulls the entire time.
That hair, man.
And then Howard Deutsch coming on and talking about making Pretty
in
Pink.
He was a good interview, too.
Like, he's a great interview, and he has a lot of great perspective, and we'll get into that when we actually cover this, that movie on the podcast in a couple episodes from now. But it just felt like the best place to start for the first of this kind of four-episode miniseries is with the actual movies of Andrew McCarthy. So we picked three big ones. And the main one being St. Elmo's Fire, because that's almost like the article comes out. They said like 18 days before St. Elmo's Fire hits theaters and becomes a massive hit. And then also is the one that like because it was New York Magazine is the one where the profile was published. Yeah. And like they say, like this movie's going to be huge. And it's the one that kind of kicks off this youth culture cinema movement in the 80s. And then we're going to do Less Than Zero, the Bret Easton Ellis adaptation that I love. And then we're going to do a kind of lesser seen one called Heaven Help Us, which was a Comedy Central and HBO classic back in the cable days. But let's go with St. Elmo's Fire. Cody.
Yeah.
I believe you texted me about watching this movie one night.
Yeah, I texted you guys whilst I was watching it. It was
and
my first time viewing.
This was before we had even come up with the idea for this miniseries.
Yeah.
So maybe you actually incepted the idea into our brains a little bit. But, like, what did you think about St. Elmo's Fire now almost 40 years later?
It's, first of all, I really enjoyed it, but it's strange, like I'm not sure what tone it's really going for. Like it seems like a big soap opera, and it's overly dramatic in moments, and it's other moments I think that are trying to be serious, but I just found really kind of comical. I don't really I enjoyed it a lot. I just don't really know what tone it was going for.
Bombastic melodrama is what I like about it, is that it's like Joel Schumacher saw TGI Fridays once and was like, you know what? That'd make a good movie.
Yeah, he feels such a weird filmmaker to do this because, you know, you have something like Lost Boys. I'm not saying like it's, but like Lost Boys is like this alternate reality. Like you watch that movie and it's like this night world, and like it's complete Joel Schumacher The music, the homosexual undertones or overtones, and then you have obviously moving up to another kind of, I feel like, Brat Pack adjacent film of Flatliners, of another really big, of like the biggest stars of that time or the up and comers, and this one is like, it's, you know, it's not a thriller, it's a straightforward. He's kind of almost like doing his John Hughes, you know, kind of ensemble film.
Yeah.
But Hughes, I've always felt like, is so good at writing from within, and he writes young people better than one of the best, I think, in the history of cinema, like, no joke. That's what made him so special. And this feels sometimes like an alien who never experienced this life that we're seeing.
Yeah. Do you think it was maybe supposed to be like a cautionary tale?
Maybe. It's also hard for me to separate this film from the Wet Hot American Summer TV series, because the 10 years later season, all it does is make fun of San Elmo's fire. It's like the entire running joke is like you're making fun of, is like a whole thing they do. And it's just like all the like ridiculous, at this point, it's hard to separate what has now become generic kind of cliche, which kind of maybe started with that film. Of the rich, you know, the Judd Nelson guys, oh, he's cheating on her, but he really wants to get married.
He can't help himself from cheating on her. It's just impossible. It's just getting thrown at him from every angle.
My take revisiting this movie was that it's almost like the lighter, poppier flip side to an actual Bret Easton Ellis novel. Is that if you saw, because they're kind of the same unlikable, yuppie, privileged archetypes that he works with, like if you just threw in like a gay orgy, maybe a serial killer or like a sex slave or something, like you kind of have one of the other movies on this list, which is less than zero. Like they kind of talk to one another in a weird way, only this is the one that where less than zero doesn't hold back. And Bret Easton Ellis in particular, like the whole point of his memoir slash novel that he wrote when he was like 19 or 20 or some insanely young age, is that he's clearly judging these people, and even, you know, his parents and the divorced upper crust of this kind of LA ecosystem that he comes from that does nothing but like fuel like a kind of hedonistic nihilism. Like, he's judging that. Where St. Elmo's Fire is almost kind of like, these guys are cool, right? And that's honestly what the main takeaway from the movie was for much of the populace, was that people idolized the Brat Pack. That's why they became a thing just as much as that article, is because, like, they looked at these young, pretty, successful people who all were doing nothing but fucking each other and hanging out in this bar. And Rob Lowe's, like, looking good and playing the sax. Demi Moore's just doing coke and fucking her boss. And, like, Emilio Estevez is a stalker, so I don't even know how he works into the mix here. Judd Nelson's, like, about to run for, like, political office and shit. But, like, everybody was like, we want to be these people. And you sit there and you go, but do you? Like, all you need is a slight change of perspective, and suddenly this becomes a Bret Easton Ellis novel.
No, you're right. And isn't it weird, too, though, that the Brat Pack was so big with teenagers, right? But this film was about college graduates. You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's not like when you get to, like, 16 Candles, or when you look at 16 Candles, or you look at, you know, Breakfast Club,
Pretty
or,
in
or
Pink,
specifically Pretty in Pink,
yeah, which McCarthy plays a big role in.
You kind of have that feeling of like, that's a film that when I watch now, it's that, especially like in the 90s, obviously 80s fever never goes away, but like in the 90s, I went through a huge phase of like, watch these all for the first time, and it was like, kind of like how I like 80s slashers. It's like, I want to live in that world. Like, I want to live in that high school. It's like, in, I want to, even like Ducky, who's annoying, I want to hang out with Ducky, you know.
Ducky.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll get to that in a different episode. But it is weird that out of all the ones that really solidified it with St. Elmo's Fire, because it is this ensemble film and it is kind of a hangout movie, like not a lot transpires beyond, like you said, soap opera beats.
Yeah.
It really is. It's melodrama.
Yeah, that's totally.
And coming from Joel Schumacher, which it's weird. I just pulled up his IMDb, and the movies that this is sandwiched between is fucking hilarious. Is that it's before Lost Boys.
Oh, before Lost Boys, you're right. Yeah, yeah.
But it's after DC Cab.
What the hell?
Which was like his narrative debut was this insane, politically incorrect, Washington set cabbie comedy with Mr. T.
Wow, what a point of view.
Well, but by the time you could see like hints of his like maximalist, almost Baz Luhrmann-esque filmmaking in St. Elmo's Fire. And then when you get to Lost Boys, it's like the camera moves, everything over the ocean. Like, he goes wild. And then obviously followed by Flatliners.
Oh, he loves the crane shot.
Oh, hell yeah.
The thing is, he packages this melodramatic tone, to your point, when you bring up Lost Boys and Flatliners and stuff, is like looking even at the rest of his filmography, is like occasionally this melodrama kind of comes through, like Dying Young is a Joel Schumacher movie. And that's, you know, kind of operating on the same frequency as
time
this.
And Time to Kill is not far off either.
Well, and that's where I was going with it, is that he takes this heightened melodramatic tone, and I think he excels when he packages that inside of an actual like genre framework.
Yes.
Like the vampire movie, or this weird kind of high concept movie about these med students basically killing themselves and bringing themselves back to life so they can glimpse the afterlife.
So
Falling Down.
I love that. Oh, I love
Michael
Falling
Douglas,
Down. Oh my God.
Which is really at its core just about a guy having a nervous breakdown because he's getting divorced.
Yep.
He loses his job too.
The Client, which is his other John Grisham adaptation.
Also a really good movie.
You know, 8mm sees him basically doing his own Paul Schrader thing. But even that has all those domestic drama scenes and stuff. It's like he keeps coming back to these moments, but St. Elmo's Fire is really kind of the purest and feature-length distillation of like his fascination with just straight up, not quite circuit, because there's not any ironic detachment, so you can't call it circian, but he's almost doing it in like old school 70s soap opera style.
Yeah, and he agreed, because it's hard for me to separate his narrative choices from his like what he would move on to become very specific stylistic choices.
Right.
You know, again, you get into the, like the later 80s, and then just further, you get to the Batman movies. I mean, like But I mean, like
nipples on the suit, baby.
But even beyond that, I mean, Batman Forever is like three steps past Flatliners. Neon colors, giant gargoyles, like even it's Gotham, but like
it's music videos.
Weird sculptures. Yeah, it all looks like a Seal video.
Yeah.
You know, and but to talk about McCarthy, watching this movie, he's the one part that strangely rings true for me. I think that he's one of the better performances in this, and like
he's really good in this.
He is this, like, we were talking off mic about him, and you made a good point, him kind of being this a little bit of a cipher, and he has kind of a non-acting style that I think really, really works for him, where he's very low-key.
Yeah.
Particularly when you have like Emilio doing, he's not in it a lot. He's actually, I think, has a lot less screen time than everybody else, but he's in this manic state the whole time. Rob Lowe is like this alcoholic, you know, fucking roller coaster. Demi Moore, too, is just fucking hoovering cocaine.
And but, jittering and fucking every older guy in sight.
Yeah, every, you know, every fucking boss she can.
She was in the convention room with like all the Middle Eastern dudes.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, I was like 5 minutes away from just a train.
Oh, yeah. That was Gangbang Central.
But McCarthy, the scene, though, where he confesses his love to Ali Sheedy, he's so good in it.
Yeah,
like where he,
that scene is great.
You see him like saying this unspoken thing that's been building up the whole movie, and the way that he like, because they use that clip in the documentary, and I was like,
of course,
I was like, holy shit, because he's so good, and Ali Sheedy's not great in that scene. She's like, you are? Like, he's like, you know, basically admits he's loved her, and she's fine, but his eyes, his like silent acting is really, really good, and so. That's what I found kind of amazing after watching the doc and kind of getting annoyed with him as the star and director of that documentary of like, but dude, you actually kind of had it. Like he
was really good.
He was really fucking good.
But he had this blankness that you could project a lot of what you were feeling as an audience member onto him.
Yeah.
And he does, to your point about his non-acting style. I don't even know if it's a non-acting style, because if you watch, he does a lot with his eyes.
Yeah.
And he does a lot with reacting to people. Honestly, the person I was thinking in modern day in comparison to him was Jeremy Allen White.
Oh, yeah.
With the Baron stuff and how they always talk about how Jeremy Allen White's a really good listener and he's a great scene partner because he responds to you like emotionally and with his eyes and stuff. And McCarthy does a lot of the same thing because he has very similar big blue eyes that he plays with. And he does a lot of stuff with his mouth and twitches and stuff and like little facial expressions. Like he's really, really good, but he still maintains this kind of all-American stoicism that allows you to kind of walk a mile in his shoes. And that's a pretty rare talent in an actor. And it's a bummer that he didn't get to do more as he kind of went along and got out of the 80s. But I mean, like, the stuff that we did get from him, pretty fucking good.
He so toes that line because he, in a lot of these films, will either play a full-on, like, the preppiest prep. Like, he's part of the upper crust. And he's always, all these films, he's usually affluent. That's the thing. It's like, even when he's kind of a nerdy version of it, like in the movie Class, which I also watched for this.
Which is his first film.
Yeah.
And where he bangs Rob Lowe's mom.
Yeah.
We'll get into that in the next episode when we focus on actual Rob Lowe movies.
I'm excited. And
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's really fucking good. It's actually a really, really good movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's surprisingly, like, I don't want to ruin it. There's some actually dark shit in it, and it's really, really good.
I was reading about it in Mike McPadden's teen movie Hell, and he kind of said something similar in his little capsule review where he's like, it almost feels like they added a bunch of raunchy jokes in afterwards to something that was supposed to be just a straight up kind of like teen drama. And he's like, the movie's really, really good. It's just almost tonally schizophrenic at times.
It's literally a follow-up to The Graduate. Like, it is the same, but like,
I'm excited,
but does some really interesting stuff with like the 80s and like, why would a woman have a relationship with a younger man? It asks that question and it makes it really fucking sad. But McCarthy's absolutely amazing in that. And like, he's a scholarship kid in that movie. So he's kind of this like fish out of water a little bit, entering this kind of very, very upper class academy where all these kids are basically one step away from Harvard. That's kind of like one of the subplots. It's like, this is like the breeding ground for the next generation of Harvard grads. And then by that, politicians and the business leaders of America. But
so there's like a Dead Poet Society kind of angle to it.
Very much. And but he kind of starts in as definitely kind of the wiener kid. A little bit like that's the energy he brings first, and you see him by the time he gets to Pretty in Pink, you know, where he's playing Blake, and it's just this like he's kind of floating on air, but it's all in the same energy, it's all there at the same time, you know.
Well, it's kind of the thing that did happen with the Brat Pack is that we started talking about it in text, is that a lot of these people were typecast to a certain degree, to where like McCarthy played, to your point, like this kind of preppy, straight-laced, like even Less Than Zero, which involves sex and drugs and everything. Like, there's a thin line between his character in St. Elmo's Fire and Less Than Zero. They're both writers. They're both, like, going to college and, like, struggling with sexuality in a way. And, like,
they both kind of want more than what this is.
They want more than their current station in life. Yeah, there's a love triangle element. You're right, Cody. And it's like, you know, it's really similar. That's what made me keep thinking they're almost like Less Than Zero is kind of like the dark side of St. Elmo's Fire's like coin, you know? But like,
now I'm wishing Spader was in St. Elmo's Fire somewhere, just being a, you know, being like Demi Moore's drug dealer or something.
Isn't it insane that Spader's not an actual member of the Brat Pack?
Yeah, it is. Like, he's in like four of the big Brat Pack movies.
Well, we're going to talk about him in multiple movies that are coming up. We talk about him in the Rob Lowe episode. We're going to have Bad Influence.
Yep.
In the John Cryer episode, we're going to have Pretty in Pink, which he's also in.
Which is like the ultimate Spader role.
Well,
probably.
I think Less Than Zero.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
But I think in terms of like film history, that I think a lot of people talk about, I think of like Pretty in Pink is like one of the ultimate 80s bad guys.
Yeah.
yeah.
is you're a real bitch, you know that? I mean, that pure Spader delivery.
Well, and Estevez also was like, the article, one of the things that's kind of cruel towards him is that it paints him as almost like this guy who has these ambitions that kind of far exceed his reach, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the guy that he sort of becomes. Like, in his episode, we'll explore like Repo Man, which is a wildly experimental kind of weirdo punk movie. You have the movie that he directed with Demi Moore in it, Wisdom, that we're going to cover. But then also, like, he's in really great mainstream pop fare, like Young Guns.
Yeah, even up to Mighty Ducks. Like, he's Mighty really, Ducks. Really good.
And, like, you... The fact that he also resembles his dad kind of helps a lot.
He looks so much like his dad in the interview.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I was shocked. I was like, wow.
Well, and Charlie Sheen, the older he gets, sounds more like his dad. And Emilio Estevez looks like his dad.
Exactly. Yeah, because Charlie Sheen's got that raspy thing that Martin Sheen was able to pull off. But like Demi Moore plays kind of the dreamboat, you know, all the way up through something like Striptease, where it's almost like, even though that movie's a massive bomb, it's kind of like the maximalist capitalization on the image she had been cultivating and even assigned with that article, is that she's always the object of affection and has kind of like a...
Literally an indecent proposal.
An indecent proposal, like she's literally the center of the central bet that's kind of put forth. And like Striptease shows her like in the weird 90s realm when even like indie movies, I watched, you ever seen Exotica? Adam McGoyan strip club movie from Canada from the early 90s. I'd never seen that before. I just watched that the other night on the new Criterion Blu-ray. And I was sitting there just being like, what was it about strip clubs in the 90s that like even Adam McGoyan was making weird arty Canadian movies about strip clubs? Fucking, you had Paul Verhoeven making the ultimate stripper movie with Showgirls.
And Joe Esterhazy also wrote
Joe Esterhazy
Striptease, right?
I don't know if he wrote Striptease. He definitely wrote Showgirls.
You're right.
But you have Demi Moore in Striptease. And then you even have shit like The Players Club, which is like the blaxploitation like strip club movie. It just, they were everywhere.
Well, you have like, I was comparing, it's interesting you have that scene with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore in the Jeep where she drives him home. It's really uncomfortable, sexually violent scene where he keeps pushing himself on her and says really fucked up shit.
And then laughs it all off when he's on the ground.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And
well, I mean, this whole movie's just a whole parade of terrible dudes.
Oh yeah,
they're all horrible.
I mean, even Andrew McCarthy in his way, and it's just like
he sucks.
Yeah, you have, but that scene is, I think, is interesting from the outside in that it's your two best looking people, like outside of the realm of Brat Pack or any of this context, like Rob Lowe and Demi Moore are like perfect looking human beings.
Well, and that becomes the role that Rob Lowe sort of inhabits too, is like,
it's all they have.
This sort of sinister bad boy, like bad influence is sort of the ultimate kind of manifestation of what his persona became, is that he's this slimy, lecherous weirdo. And then lo and behold, he gets busted on camera with underage girls.
But that's all, I think it's like, I don't want to take too much away from him, but like you get to Parks and Rec and he finds this new groove where he's basically playing himself. Like from seeing the interview in Bratz and watching other interviews, he is this like ball of positive energy.
Yeah,
and also
an old charmed guy.
And who's just and so that kind of worked where he's like, you even watch behind the scenes of Parks and Rec too, and he's just that character. You know, and it's like, cool, I'm gonna get paid to basically be myself.
Well,
and to kind of make fun of my old star image a little bit.
Honestly, it's the same thing that Robert Downey Jr. does, who also shows up in a bunch of these movies we're going to talk about. But it's kind of what he does, particularly with Tony Stark, is that he just gets to do it on literally the grandest scale possible, is that he's almost playing characters that are a direct response to his bad reputation, to where Tony Stark is this guy who used to be a bad boy and used to have errors in his ways and finds the light and reforms and becomes a superhero and fights for good, never is able to lose the smarmy, I'm smarter than everybody and cockier and cooler than everybody every time that I walk into a room sort of charm that even straight up is Robert Downey Jr. Like our buddy Shapiro has been like, I've seen Robert Downey Jr. in person. He is just Tony Stark.
Yeah,
like,
he's
that's
just playing
him.
Himself.
You know, but I mean, Rob Lowe, with his character in Parks and Rec, like the straight-laced, super nice guy and everything, that feels like a direct response to all of the shit that he went through in the 90s with getting busted and stuff. Is like he almost had to do on-screen rehabilitation to his image because nobody was going to buy him otherwise, you know?
Yeah, and it was like a forgiveness tour,
right?
You know, kind of thing.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Speaking of Robert Downey Jr., let's talk about Less Than Zero, the movie that I was dreading revisiting because this was a massive film for me when I was growing up, especially like 15-year-old me, is when I was starting to get really into like books and want to be a writer and everything. Like I loved Bret Easton Ellis. And I even bought this movie on tape and I watched it so many times to where even though I really love the book and I think it's one of his best works and it's radically different from the movie, the images from the film supersede the actual narrative of the book now when I think of Less Than Zero. And Andrew McCarthy in particular, every time I read a Bret Easton Ellis novel, including The Shards, his book from last year, which is a prequel to Less Than Zero, all I can picture is Andrew McCarthy as Clay. Like, to me, he's the greatest representation of a Bret Easton Ellis character because McCarthy taps into this vapid loneliness and that cold kind of isolation that Ellis is just... like, is basically his bread and butter as a writer. And, man, 10 minutes into this movie, I was in tears. Like, I was a complete wreck the entire time. And I grew to maybe even have a greater appreciation of this film as a 41-year-old than I did when I was a 15-year-old. Like, I love it to death. It's close to, like, it's easily top 50 movie of all time for me, if not in top 25. Like, I think it's just a tremendous work.
It's so fucking sad. Like
it's such a Jacob coded movie.
Oh no, I watched it because I'd never seen it before, and you were like,
same.
And you were like, you're gonna like it, and I did a lot because it's like Michael. You're like the Michael Mann colors. I love Douglas Sirk as well, and I think I texted you while I was watching. I said, and I was just like, well, duh. You're like, duh, it's Bret Easton Ellis. I said, man, no one makes being rich look worse than Bret Easton Ellis.
Just miserable.
Because like you watch it and that not one
money
part
is terrible, guys.
But
it's
not one part
thing
of that movie did I feel like I wanted anyone's life.
Yeah.
It was just like she's a model now, like she's living the high life. You have obviously none of them have to, I mean, Downey's in trouble with money, but like the other two,
$40,000.
Yeah,
$50,000.
Yeah.
$50,000 of coke debt.
Yeah.
How much coke does one have to do?
It's a wonder he was still alive when the movie started.
And that's watching it now in hindsight, too, and knowing that while making this, Downey was in that.
In the throes.
In
of
the throes of that.
He was just method acting, guys. Come on.
But
no, he really. I mean,
I know,
this,
I'm joking.
There is something freaky about watching it now.
It felt voyeuristic to me.
Yeah, like he's. It very much feels like you're not watching a work of acting. Like, he's incredible in it, but when you throw in his actual real life struggles, like, you wonder how much of it is real.
Well, the scene where they're getting him clean. Like and there's that wide angle shot of him puking and he like gets toward the camera and he's just like drenched in sweat and bags under his eyes. Just like
pale as a ghost.
Yeah, it's a really horrible movie. I mean, just about addiction in general. And but also again, like just feeling it feels like there's just no escape. And then, again, it does feel like this like very classic Hollywood, like you said, Sirky, and like that red Corvette is right out of, it seems like it's right out of Written on the Wind. These you know, these fucking convertibles they're trying to use to escape this trapped, you know, this trapped kind of environment they're in. You know what I mean?
Well, and also it's just the heightened nature of it all and how the movie is also sort of, in the same way that Ellis's text is, it's making fun of these people too. Yeah. Not necessarily our main trio of Andrew McCarthy, Jamie Gertz, and Robert Downey Jr. But I mean, in that whole Christmas scene where you're basically hanging out in the living room while all of these rich divorcees don't say anything to one another, and then Andrew McCarthy and Jamie Gertz are just getting their fuck on in the hallway to, like, heavy metal, like, almost like Aerosmith guitar riffs. Like, that's purposely funny. Like, they know, like, this is ridiculous. This is Christmas for these fucking idiots.
Yeah, it's such a weird scene, too, like, with the dad... His dad, like, making this long speech with his, like, new, very, very young wife, and then his ex-wife at the other end of the table. And it's just like, oh my God. Like you said, it's just everyone's probably been divorced 4 fucking times. Just the world that's created. I've never read the book. I've read other Easton Ellis, and this does still line up with that just, like, hellscape of the rich and famous.
Well, and just the, like, the icy blues and, like, bright, lush neon pinks. And, like, it's good to remember that. I forgot until the credits were rolling that Ed Lockman, who is Todd Haynes' regular DP, is
shooting. Did he shoot Far From Heaven then, too?
Yeah.
That makes all the fucking sense in the world, then.
So, like,
yeah.
he creates these images and he lets the characters just kind of exist in the frame like mannequins, kind of in the same way that Michael Mann positions them. And, like, there's also just all that amazing set design. If anything, it captures such a specific moment in, like, L.A. pop art culture and fashion trends. And, like, when he walks through that party with the TV screens early, and then he finds her in that plastic, like, winter wonderland cave, and they look at each other in those crazy, like, Vangelis style synth look, and they look at each other for the first time. Like, that was the moment where I just lost it. And I was pretty much crying throughout the rest of the movie, because it's just, it does the same thing. And I hate to keep bringing up Michael Mann and, like, leading people down the path thinking that this is going to be the same quality as a Michael Mann movie, because it isn't. And, like, this is either going to work. You're either going to buy into, like, the histrionics of this film, or it's going to not work for you at all. But, like, the way they look at each other from across the room, like, it's the same way that Mann loves to just convey just pages and pages of, like, lover's backstory with just nothing but a glance, you know. And it does the same exact thing. And, man, this movie just fucking kills me.
They even make Downey smoking crack in the back of the club. Just, it's a beautiful shot. Like, they kind of romanticize it.
Yeah, where he's, like, hanging on the cage and, exactly, like, and he's just lighting the crack pipe underneath. And then also, like, we brought up Spader earlier.
This is peak Spader for me.
Yeah, Spader is Rip, the massive cocaine dealer who is very much self-aware that he is a vampire as, like, a human being. And, like, you know, there's that awesome moment in that party scene early where Clay looks at Rip and goes, "Oh, man, aren't all these people great?" And Rip goes, "These people are assholes." and Clay just goes, "Great customers, though, right?" But, like, Rip kind of shrugs him off. Like, Spader is the other one in this movie who totally gets, even though this is a lot different from the Rip in the books, he captures the essence of, like, Ellis's Predators really well, because a lot of these characters and these types of characters show up in his books again and again.
Well, he's so good. You're talking about, like, the blankness of, like, you know, the blankness of McCarthy, but, like, that's the thing Spader's always been great with too, is
his is a ferocity, though.
But
yeah, he looks like he's going to eat you alive. Yes. At any moment.
Yeah. Well, he's got the intensity of, like,
it's like a jungle cat honing in on.
Well,
a prey.
I think about, I mean, the ultimate is him and Wolf, right?
Yes.
Is, like, him at, like, that height. But I think of a movie like, it's, this world is not far off from the world of, like, disaffected rich people and, like, Crash. You know what
right.
I mean? Of this empty guy.
Which, lo and behold, another Jacob Knight favorite.
Oh, yeah, and I love it, too. But the film I kept thinking of, we were talking offline, was, like, White Sleeper, you know, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Another patron saint of the podcast, Paul Schrader. And we were kind of talking about, like, it's another film about this just this inescapable night world, right? And with both of them, obviously a lot of narrative similarities of a kind of an old love that went bad, and he's trying to rekindle this. The sense of something ending, you know, like with Light Sleeper, it's okay.
Or wanting to escape a world.
Yeah, or he has to escape because, like, right. his meal ticket is going away in Light Sleeper of, you know, Susan Sarandon's, like, going to shut down her drug business. And he's like, well, I don't have any transferable skills. You right. know, all I am is this guy who journals and thinks about my ex-girlfriend while I try to stay clean. But the thing, the scenes of him...
Are you saying that Paul Schrader protagonists have no other life skills? All they know how to do is drink, journal, maybe deal drugs, and shoot people.
And brood.
Yeah, exactly.
And just
be sad.
Be lonely. Yeah, whenever I'm having a bad, lonely night, I'm like, I'm just a Schrader character. I'm just going to run with it. I'm just going to wrap all my shit and clothing, like, in card counter and...
And start just writing and self-narrating about the apocalypse.
Yeah, and just, like... sleeping around from different positions on my giant bed like Willem Dafoe.
You don't do this already?
I do. But it's...
Just with a CPAP machine on.
Yeah, very, very sexy, I know. I live alone.
You ever feel like an engineer from Aliens when you're trying to go to sleep?
I feel like fucking Darth Vader, man. But you have the scenes of Light Sleeper, too, of these, like, larger-than-life, like, downtown New York clubs, and... It also connects back to Schumacher in that party scene you're talking about could have been a Schumacher scene.
Oh, 100%.
This, like, this art installation, it's like, I believe it exists, but it's a very specific choice.
I found myself wondering. I was like, is that shit just there all the time? Like, are we
probably
just
not.
Just your living room has a million TVs.
But they are
in
the art scene. A lot of their friends are artists, it seems like, in the movie.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that, like, that's another thing that this... movie captures is that, like, a lot of these scenes are illustrated very similarly in, like, Ellis's other novels, is because he just existed in that scene of artists and rich kids and everything, because, like, in the same way that Roger Avery's other Ellis adaptation, Rules of Attraction,
oh, yeah.
you know, gets all of the
James Vanderbeek one.
Yeah, yeah. He gets all of the hedonism of the partying from Rules of Attraction completely right, because, like, the dress to get screwed and stuff like that, that's all straight from the book. And, like, Ellis disowned this movie for a long time, saying that, oh, it doesn't share anything with the novel except for a title and characters of the same name. But then he's kind of come around on it over the years. He also appears in the documentary, which is funny too.
Oh, that's right.
Is that he's come around on it as the years have gone by, and has basically said, like, it's a really cool snapshot, and it gets the vibe of what that world was like, because there was a rumor for a long time, and you don't know how much of this is just, you know, Tarantino smoked a blunt and was like, wouldn't it be cool, man? But, like, Tarantino has threatened his own Less Than Zero adaptation to pair with Roger Avery's Rules of Attraction for a long time. But, I mean, that feels just about as an imminent of a threat as, like, the Vega brothers from, like, back when.
Or Star Wars, or Star Trek 4.
Exactly. You know? Like, one of the movies that he wanted to make, like, time and time again. Or, like, that one of the Kill Bill prequels or sequels or whatever he talked about. So who knows if that's actually a real thing that he even... I'm sure he wrote a Less Than Zero screenplay at some point and then just threw it in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah.
But, like, I would love to see it, because his vision of Bret Easton Ellis's L.A. would be even more nihilistic and probably closer to the book, because the book is, like... Have you read the book, Cody?
No.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... And, like, the Clay from the book... He's bisexual. He gets it. He parties. He's not like this anti-drug crusader. He has flings. Like, it basically takes place on about a week that he's home for Christmas.
Yeah.
From, I believe it's Bennington College is the Connecticut college that's in Ellis's novels. But he comes home and, you know, he parties. He gets into sexual trysts with both guys and girls. He pursues his own fling, his old fling. Julian is, like, not a major character in the book.
Wild.
Like, he kind of is. Like, he goes seeking him out, but, like, Julian's a heroin addict who does owe $50,000 to a dealer.
Uh-huh.
and he loans him the money, but then Julian more or less like disappears from the novel. Like, and there is the gay sex pimping subplot, but in the book, where in the movie, the most questionable aspect of it is that it's almost like, what's the ultimate thing a guy can do to debase himself for more crack? It's suck a dick. In the book, it's a little more fluid, let's say, sexually, because Clay actually goes with him when he meets one of his Johns and watches him get fucked in one scene. And like and Rip, the drug dealer in the book, is a much bigger character, and he more or less hangs out with Clay the entire time. There's never some huge showdown or whatever. In fact, the main climax of the novel is that they go out to this big party together, and Rip basically looks at him when they're all fucked up, and he's like, hey, let's go back to my apartment. I want to show you something. And Rip takes him back to show him that he has a 14-year-old girl basically tied up on a mattress as a sex slave for like a couple weeks or something. And Ellis, being Ellis, of course, goes into graphic detail about like her pussy's all dried up and crusty because it's been used so much. And like, yeah, the book is like,
wow,
like the movie's almost like the PG-13 version of an X-rated novel. Like the novel goes really fucking hard. And then the novel doesn't end with them fleeing off together from this world. He just leaves.
Yeah.
He just decides, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. And he leaves everything behind.
Huh.
Then the book ends.
Does anybody learn anything?
No.
Okay.
But I mean, nobody learns anything in Ellis's novels. That's kind of the point of them, is that they're all these like nihilistic existential exercises about people who have done nothing but experience excess because of their excessive wealth.
And I was surprised watching because I'd never seen it before, and having read some Ellis and seeing other Ellis adaptations, which I believe are closer to the books, it's like,
yeah, like American Psycho and Rules of Attraction are way closer to the text.
Yeah, and you have like, again, when I first met Clay in the film, I said, oh, he's going to be a drug addict as well, because I just thinking it's Ellis. I'm like, oh, it's all going to be about them all on the spiral down together. I didn't know it was just
like
about,
he had to escape to stop doing drugs, and then he like falls back into it all.
Yeah, so like my brain probably made it more Ellis than the movie actually was.
No, the movie's almost like an after school special version of a Bret Easton Ellis novel.
Yeah.
But honestly, I still love this shit because like it's filmed with such fucking style and verve. Like that scene by the swimming pool where Clay confronts Julian.
Yeah.
And finally gives in to give him the money is like just face meltingly beautiful because of the way Ed Lockman like captures that chlorinated blue water, like that bathes everything and makes it like this electric high C blue the entire time. And it's just so fucking awesome. And again, that Vangelis style, because it's Thomas Newman who does the score.
Yes, yeah.
And it's just this like almost like drowning synths that fill every frame and really heighten all of like the emotion that's going on. And then also just some of the location stuff, like when they find like that park scene where like Downey wakes up on a park bench. They have that heart to heart where he goes, hey man, what's going on? And then the camera just slowly pulls back, and all of a sudden you realize that his fucking convertible like Mustang that he crashed it behind, like it's such an amazing shot. Or like when they find Downey just sitting on that cliff that's surrounded by the ocean.
Yeah, that
and
was
it
great.
Has that amazing line when he leaves, when he, you know, Julian goes, oh, be careful, and then, you know, Clay calls back, oh, watch out for the sharks, and he's like, oh, they know me, you know. And it's dude, it's this movie.
Good shit.
The good shit. Man, that scene where he makes out with fucking Jamie Gertz in the convertible and all of those bikers swarm around them. Like, that's something out of a Joel Schumacher
movie. I was going to say, that's fucking
Lost
Boys.
That feels like Lost Boys.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
It's absolutely incredible. This movie, I've never gotten to see it projected on the big screen. If there was ever, like, I don't even care if it's a DCP. Like, I would prefer a 35mm print. So if anybody out there has one and you can bring that to Austin, like, you want to watch me just melt into a complete puddle, play less than zero on 35 millimeter, I'll lose it completely.
Well, kind of the unspoken thing too is, I mean, we keep talking about the directors of these movies too, and the cinematographers. It's like, that's what makes these so. It's not just like these actors in this vacuum, right? There's these amazing filmmakers, like artistic filmmakers they're working with, and we're always thinking of, again, this is like 80s pastiche just blast on your face. I mean, like, the whole look of Less Than Zero.
One, it's also like, you know, this movie takes place in 87.
Yeah.
You know, or it's produced in 86, 87. We just saw a movie, Maxine, trying to replicate that time period, and it does an okay job, but then when you actually go back and watch the real thing, like, something like Less Than Zero, you can't recreate this. Like, they're literally capturing a moment in time that feels authentic to, like, the pop cultural movements that are happening, right down to the fact that Rick fucking Rubin does the music for the movie. Like, he's the music supervisor. Another movie from my youth is our last movie of the episode, which is Heaven Help Us, a movie I've seen probably 40 times in, you know, stops and starts and various viewings, because this was a Comedy Central classic growing up, kind of the same way PCU was, in that it was just, I would come home from school or work or whatever, and it would just be on at random times. So, like, I've seen Heaven Help Us so many times, and now it's a movie that's, like, kind of hard to see.
Yeah, this was my first time. I'd never seen it, and I do... We're going to be talking about a film in a later podcast episode, one of my favorites, The Chocolate War. And there were so many films this era, and so many actually McCarthy films that take place at boys' schools or at Catholic schools. And McCarthy is so often playing this fish out of water. Like, the beginning of this, pretty much the same as the beginning of Class. It's this guy, it's different part of town. With this film, it's obviously, we kind of find out his parents are dead. He's staying with his grandparents, and he and his sister, obviously he's had to transfer schools. And
to a Catholic school? Is that what this is?
Yeah, Catholic school.
Okay.
Yeah, straight up Catholic school.
So let's litigate this real quick. Are these motherfuckers in these brown robes, are they priests? What's happening here?
I mean, they're ordained priests.
But they call each other brother. But they don't call each other father.
That's what they call them in all. They call in all Catholic schools. Like, you can have, like, the head priest, then you have the brothers are all, like, the teachers.
Did you go to Catholic school?
All my friends did, but I've also watched a lot of other movies.
Did they know monks too?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think they're monks.
If you go to St. Ed's, the professors are monks.
Are they really?
Yeah, I don't know if they.
Do they wear robes too?
Yep.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yep, true story.
When you watch Chocolate War, they all wear monks. All wear robes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all the teachers wear. They might, yeah, trippy. Yeah, it's
the robes and the ropes.
I've never seen The Chocolate War.
You're going to.
A Keith Gordon special.
It's, so maybe I'm wrong calling them priests, but they are obviously ordained men who have taken the, you know.
Men of the cloth.
Men of the cloth.
We'll say.
Yeah. But
does
this
mean they can have sex or not?
No. No, they're all.
They're not allowed to bang?
No.
John Hurd is
the nuns that couldn't. I thought
John Hurd's gambling and smoking cigarettes in this.
Yeah,
I think he could get his dick wet.
He cannot get his dick wet.
He cannot get
no,
his dick wet.
No, I am 100% on that. There's,
okay.
Yeah.
What if he just soaks it? You know, like the
just the
Mormons? Yeah. No. I mean, he can. He's not allowed to. Priests and those guys do a lot of shit they're not supposed to do.
The bed shakers, you know.
But this film went a lot darker than I expected.
It's, you want to talk about a schizophrenic tone where, like, St. Elmo's Fire has a pretty unified, soapy tone. Less Than Zero certainly has a unified, cold,
yeah,
distant, morose tone. This one goes from being, like, a zany, almost like Boys Will Be Boys, like, Porky-style prank movie, to then all of a sudden, monks are just beating the shit out of, like, 14-year-old kids, and you're like, what the fuck is happening? At least there's no raping.
It seems, at the same time,
it's not
nobody else is getting their dick wet. You know what I mean?
It seems to kind
of... Kevin Bacon shows up. You better be afraid.
Strangely work together, though, because while it is, I think, a little schizophrenic, like, you have the way that these boys become friends because it's like they're in like war together, right? It's like we're in this shithole of a place, we're mistreated, we're beaten. You know, it's like a fucking Smith song, you know, about like getting like your hands wrapped.
Ooh, I like that. Smith song.
I mean, getting like getting beat by the headmaster kind of thing. And these guys kind of, even you think early on that the Kevin Dillon character is going to be like this bully bad guy the whole time. And it's very quickly, I love the line where he's like, look, man, I either have to kick your ass or we got to be friends. I can't, like, that's...
I got to save face.
I got to save face. And it's just like, you
we
see the
politics.
We haven't
even reviewed what the fucking cast of this movie
is.
Oh,
it's insane.
It's insane. It's Kevin Dillon in full Johnny Drama mode.
Yep.
And then you also have, you know, Andrew McCarthy as the main character. Stephen Jeffries, who future gay porn star Stephen Jeffries.
But
and,
also...
And Fright Night star.
Evil Ed.
Evil Ed. And then you also have, as the brothers, you've got Donald Sutherland, John Hurd, and Wallace fucking Shawn.
In one scene.
Shows up for one scene with a wild lisp. And then Mary Stuart Masterson is the love interest.
Yep.
As like a teenage girl who runs. So here's my other question, too, while we're on the, like, I have a lot of issues with how these men of the cloth are presented and how their powers are enacted, because like Mary Stuart Masterson basically runs a little soda jerk shop.
Yeah.
Is that the best way to describe it?
Yeah. No, it smells
pop and pop.
Well, yeah, where the you go, you hang, you drink milkshakes, you get a Coke, you smoke cigarettes inside, and it becomes like, you can tell it's almost like the boys' illicit clubhouse, and she's cool with it because she makes money off of it, and that's what keeps her afloat.
And her dad is in deep, deep depression, a melancholy.
She literally says he's suffering from the melancholia.
Yep.
Because her mom killed herself?
No, his lover, who is truly in love with, not his mom, not
that's
the mom,
it.
Killed herself because they couldn't be together. Then the mom left him on top of that when she found out what happened.
Yeah, he went 0-2 there. Now the brother can't talk.
Oh, damn.
But here's my question. Why are the brothers just allowed to raid this place? Like, are they cops too? Like, this, their authority, you would think, would stop at campus. They're just allowed to just stomp in and fuck, like, shops up in the local, like, community? That seems like a stretch.
It's right next, it's right next to the school. And
it's,
I think,
organized crime. It's
the like
mob
their,
with more steps.
And it's like their parish, too. It's like the whole area, I think, there. That's how I read it, because they
do
have...
nobody's going to stand up to them, obviously, because they're priests or monks or whatever the fuck they are. But, like... So you get it, why nobody retaliates against them, but at the same time, like, fuck you, dude. If you came in here, like, I would come up to the campus and, like, beat a monk's ass. Like, I don't care. Like, that's my business. What's wrong with you?
Well, and it gets like, it's a kind of, it's a messy script also, because they're trying to build up this idea that
it feels more like a memoir than Less Than Zero does, the adaptation.
No, it kind of reminds me of like a Brighton Beach memoir, kind of like that kind of thing, like a Neil Simon kind of thing. And that's him, right? Neil Simon. Yeah. And this was, you have this kind of blossoming romance between Mary Stuart Masterson and Andrew, you know, McCarthy. As you know, she's like, I'm not going to school, and basically keeping, they're the same age, but all the guys have made a pass at her. But the one person, there's something special about Andrew McCarthy.
It's the new kid.
And he's
got that untainted daze.
And he's just that kind of that blank thing. You just kind of want to soak him, you know?
Why was this being ran on Comedy Central? It seems like such a traumatic film.
Well, I think because of the Porky style elements.
Yeah.
Is because where it's like, because a lot of it takes place or revolves around their pranks. You know what I mean? Like, they cut the head off of that one statue. They do the clacker thing in the early cathedral scene where they're making everybody stand up and sit down. Taking the desk apart.
There are scenes right out of Chocolate War in this. Like, there's just whole plots, whole scenes.
So, like, a lot of it is, like, almost like a silly coming-of-age thing or like, you know, the scene where Kevin Dillon gets his dad's car and takes the loose ladies out from, I guess, the girls' school down the block or something. I don't know where the fuck they came from. But they take these girls out from the town, on a date and they get stuck on the bridge and they destroy the car when the bridge starts rotating and everything. That's pretty fucking funny. There's like, that's kind of the thing with this movie is that the funny parts are fucking funny, but then the dark parts are fucking dark.
I mean, I feel like you could pair this with like the Dangerous Lives of Ultra Boys or something.
No, that, actually, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that movie until right now, frankly.
Yeah.
Well, then you
that
have
good
because yeah, it builds to the really amazing climax of you have the bad brother who is obviously a sadist, and from the early scenes
he enjoys beating the kids.
Yeah, it's just like he's looking for it, and you have
so like here since you're on the topic of this dude, when he does the whole thing when the desk falls apart and Andrew McCarthy, he makes Andrew McCarthy stand up in the middle of the class. And a scene that's actually really well acted. And honestly, yeah. I'm not 100% sure how they shot it.
Yeah, for the
hitting.
Because
he hits, he has Andrew McCarthy hold his hands out and then begins to hit them with a wooden paddle that he calls patience, which is fucked up. Like, he's almost like a Stephen King villain.
Yeah.
Like, he's so fucked up.
But this shit is like happens in schools like that.
I know, but like, you've never read The Talisman, right?
No.
He reminds me of a monk version of, so in The Talisman, which is kind of like this crazy fantasy novel that Stephen King wrote with Peter Straub, is it's about this kid, Jack, who's traveling across the country to obtain this magical talisman that will save his mom, who is like the last B movie actresses and who's dying slowly. And there's a whole sequence that takes place at this boy's home called Sunlight Gardeners School for Wayward Boys, if I remember right. It takes up like a 200 page chunk in the middle of the novel. It's fucking awesome. One of the greatest things that Stephen King's ever written. But it has this crazy manic preacher type who's the head of the school. It's almost like the Donald Sutherland character, if Donald Sutherland was out of his fucking mind and like a ranting, raving kind of like Baptist type. But then all of these kind of like upper class boys are like his like Nazi kind of acolytes who enforce all of the rules and like beat the other students and especially the lower school students who like don't comply and everything. But like he seems like the grown up version of one of those kids who just takes pleasure in beating the fuck out of the ones that show any kind of weakness or whatever. But like when he starts hitting Andrew McCarthy's hands with that fucking paddle, how does that not break his hands? Like that would, you know, maybe I have little dainty girl hands, but like, I feel like I would break at least a finger doing that. 'Cause he hits the fuck out of those.
So when I was growing up, we threw,
this is going to get dark.
No, but we threw, when I was in elementary school, paddling was allowed at my school.
And the dick?
No, on and you had to, if you didn't want your kids to be paddled, that you had to sign a fucking form. So my parents signed a form. They did not want the principal paddling me when I was a fucking kindergartner.
That's
like,
nice.
And that was 1991. Jeez. So like, this is like not. And my dad used to tell me stories because when they, and this, he's, you know, grew up in high school in the 60s, that like they do in this movie, you would swim naked. That's what like the guys would do. Like, you didn't have swimsuits at school. It was very normal to swim naked in gym because it was just boys.
Very not gay at all either.
No, but my dad told me stories of, they had paddles and it was the name of the school backwards on the, carved into the paddle.
Yeah.
And so if you fucked up, they spanked the shit. You literally had stencil on your ass, yep, the name of the high school for like a week. Like this, it's like, so it's just so fucked up. It's not just Catholic schools, you know.
Oh, again, fraternity stuff too. Because like my grandfather kept his fraternity paddle.
Oh, yeah.
And after he passed, my dad had it, and we had it in our house and stuff. And there would be days where, like, especially when we were little kids, he would jokingly be like, "You want me to get Grandpa's paddle? What's going on?" And
it's the whole "cut me a switch."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, kind of thing. Yeah.
I think Ben Affleck still has his from Dazed and Confused.
Well, maybe. I would hope so. Yeah. Well, if I was that character, I would keep that.
No, I think there's a version of it at Top Notch on the north side.
Oh, yeah. Is there really?
Yeah, because there's a couple memorabilia pieces inside. I think they have at least one version of the Fock Hue paddle.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, it's like behind glass when you're getting fried chicken.
It makes sense. They still have like classic car meetups.
Oh yeah, it's so fucking cool.
The only thing that doesn't work about Heaven Help Us for me is how neat and tidy the ending is, because it's a great ending. Don't get me wrong, but like for a piece that feels as fragmented and kind of like a hazy, almost a collection of memories, you know, those don't normally have narrative, you know, they're just a place and time. And like looking back, almost like Stand By Me, kind of has a narrative, but not really. It's just
American
a guy
graffiti.
Like looking back and being like, remember that time we all walked to a place to see a dead body? Yeah. Like this has a very similar feel to that, where it's just like, there's not a ton of narrative momentum to it. So when it suddenly turns into this kind of like comeuppance story, especially with like John Hurt, who's also fucking awesome in this.
Yeah. And like when, everything.
Well, he's good in everything, but he's really, really cool in this as like the hip monk, you know, who like smokes cigarettes and gambles with the kid and will come hang out at the soda jerk place and whatever. Like,
he's like De Niro in Sleepers.
Yeah, he's really great. I mean, this movie is basically Sleepers without all the ass rape.
Right. That's what I honestly thought was going to happen. Like, I thought like when they opened that door, he's like, go in that dark hole. I'm like, geez, are we going here?
Yeah.
You know?
Who's getting clapped?
The prequel to Spotlight? This is getting bad, man.
Good Lord.
They knew.
They let it
and
happen.
They let it happen.
No, but I mean, this is a pretty interesting relic of 80s filmmaking that, like, I had to watch on. I'm glad that I had a DVD just sitting around, because like, how did you watch this? Because like, I even went
up
on
for Cinemax.
Okay. Yeah. That was the way that I saw it, is that the only way to watch it was to like sign up for Cinemax. It's not really, I don't think it's on Hulu or any, it might've been on Hulu or something.
I had to buy it through Stars. I think
you're right. It was Stars. That's where I got it.
Well, I mean, I think they're they're not the same.
No,
thing
and then anymore. Cinemax is what I had to do to get less than zero.
Jesus. That's how streaming gets you anymore, man.
I'm probably gonna forget.
You have 9 subscriptions.
I'm gonna forget
of one
to fucking
episode.
Yeah, fucking forget to get rid of that. Yeah.
But I mean, like, it's now become a thing that used to be on all the time and is perfect for this podcast because like you have to seek it out. But like, it's totally worth anybody's time.
Well, it also brings us full circle to the idea, back to the whole idea of the Brat Pack, right? Is that this movie does not make me think Brat Pack, because it is this like different. It doesn't take place in the 80s. It's this, like you said, kind of little memoir curio which with not a fun tone all the time. It just happens to have Andrew McCarthy in it. I think there are fewer films that match what people consider Brat Pack movies. Like, we're spreading out from that, right? There's a lot of interesting films these actors were in that are not just rom-com
teamwork. Or John Hughes movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's not just The Breakfast Club. It's not just Pretty in Pink. You know, like, these guys were all trying. Yeah, not just 16 Candles, but, like, a lot of these guys were trying to do something interesting. Like, one of the movies that I wanted to talk about that I worked in, because I was going to watch Class, but then I realized we were kind of saving more of the discussion of that one for the Rob Lowe episode, is I found this movie on Prime, again, that, like, it seemed to be the only real source. Like, I couldn't even really find a DVD of it or anything, called Kansas, with Andrew McCarthy and Matt Dillon. And, man, this is, you want to talk about forgotten, not quite a gem, but like a solid, just 3-star kind of weird programmer, is that it's sort of like a Jim Thompson novel come to life, but a little softer. It's about these two drifters where, you know, the movie opens with Andrew McCarthy jumping onto a train and he finds Matt Dillon. And Matt Dillon is a criminal who's just drifting from town to town, getting into trouble and then getting out, but he's a bank robber. And they start this friendship where he kind of tags along, and they end up robbing a bank against Andrew McCarthy's will. And then in the ensuing chase, they get split up and go their separate ways. Like, Matt Dillon goes and like joins a carnival for like a little bit and like works as like a carny hand while he's like plotting how he's going to get back to Andrew McCarthy, because they've stashed the money. And, like, they need to get it, but they need to, like, come back together in order for that to happen. And then Andrew McCarthy escapes and becomes like a ranch hand on this big sweeping kind of like farm, and falls in love with the farmer's daughter while he's just working the fields with, I can't remember the actor's name, but there's that black character actor who plays Billy Bean's assistant.
Oh my God, Moneyball. I love him. Oh, and he's also in Death Warrant.
Yeah, and he's in a bunch of stuff, but I can never remember the actor's name. But he plays one of the other farmhands, and they become like best buds and like drink together after work and stuff. But then it becomes about Matt Dillon tracking him down so that they can get the money together. And it's just this weird, sweaty, kind of languid, southern gothic crime movie that when the violence pops off, like Matt Dillon gets involved in a kind of like True Romance, Bonnie and Clyde style love affair with Kira Sedgwick, where she becomes like his almost like captive as he goes and just keeps doing crimes, you know, and there's a shootout, like a whole Peckinpah kind of bloody like finale. Like, it's pretty cool. And like, just kind of one of these weird movies that Andrew McCarthy appeared in. And it does kind of back up the thesis of like, hey, he got labeled as part of the Brat Pack, but he was obviously interested in more complex material than just, you know, being in Pretty in Pink 2.
Yeah, and I feel like Less Than Zero is that. I mean, you're obviously an adaptation of a bestseller.
A best-selling edgy novel from a young, like, writer who's supposed to be the voice of, like, kind of the dark side of his generation. Like, yeah, if you want to appear in that, you have weird taste.
Yeah, totally. And to, you know, Cody's earlier point too, being this New York theater kid,
right?
You know,
yeah,
it
definitely
like,
indicates you have dramatic aspirations.
Well, because he even talks about, there's that great moment where he's speaking with Howard Deutsch, and they talk about how Pretty in Pink initially tested poorly
with that different ending,
right? And they had to reshoot it, and they gave him one day to reshoot a new ending. And Andrew McCarthy was in the middle of a play where he was playing a soldier and had to shave his head. So for the reshoots and the ending that's actually used, he's wearing a ridiculous wig the whole time.
And I never
like
knew
an
that.
Approximation of his hair. He seems to think the wig's really, really bad.
Yeah, he thinks
like,
he has like a dead cat on his head or something.
I look at it and I'm like, it just looks like your hair, bro. Like, yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
Same. Yeah, when they showed the clip in the doc, I was like, it looks fine to me. It's actually one of the better wigs I've seen.
And also that scene's so good that you don't give a fuck.
Yeah, you're not looking at his hair.
You guys want to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right.
Back to Cali, Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali. I don't think so. I'm going back to Cali, Cali, Cali. I'm going back to Cali. I don't think so. Going back to Cali, styling, profiling, smiling, and smiling while in the sun. The top is down on the black Corvette, and it's fly cause it's sitting on the North steering wheel, plushed out, gold leaf phantom top, and three girls waiting. The chrome is shining, passing all the cars on the way. Push play.
And we're back talking about the movies of Andrew McCarthy. We're going to do some questions, but we're going to do it a little different than we usually do. We're going to make some hyper-specific questions, really do a throwback to when we first started this podcast and try to ask each other the most outlandish shit that kind of pops into our noggins. Starting with Fuck, Marry, Kill. Judd Nelson and his yuppie douchebag from St. Elmo's Fire. James Spader's drug dealing vampire from Less Than Zero. Or John Hurd's monk from Heaven Help Us.
Easy.
Go
light,
on.
Light work.
No, you marry John Hurd, definitely.
You think so?
Yeah, because you don't have to bang then. He's a brother. You just got have a nice hangout time.
Oh.
He wouldn't want to bang anyway. Then I definitely kill Judd.
It's a long marriage without any banging.
I would just cheat. I cheat on my monk husband.
It's fucked up.
And then I would. That's what cheating's for.
Jesus Christ. Then, I leave the monk alone and prowl the streets.
Let the monk watch.
Oh my God, if you put the monk in the cuck chair, we're going to hell.
And then, we're already there. And then I would kill Judd Nelson. And I would fuck the shit out of Rip.
That's 100% the right answer. There's no other way to do that.
Just fucking maul James Spader.
But he's a beautiful man.
But are you topping him or is he topping you? Are you guys flipping?
They're what's it called? They're switchers. There's a term for that.
I don't know. I'd
flex.
I'd fuck him.
Just mauling James Spader's preppy drug dealing butthole.
Yeah, but I'd stay
in his big beautiful house.
But until he got old and crusty, like in Blacklist.
That's
what I'm really waiting for.
Does Michael Bowen watch, mm-hmm. like from the corner with the weird slit in his eyebrow? Does he videotape?
Yep. Bill.
Bill.
The character. Yeah.
I think it's Bill.
What about you guys?
That's
same.
That's the exact right answer. Yeah.
I'd probably marry Judd Nelson.
Because the money?
Well, because he's going to cheat on me, so we're not going to have to fuck, so I'm just going to spend all of his money. That's the only thing. Like, monks be broke, dog.
So you're killing a monk?
Yeah. Well, yeah, no. I'm fucking James Spader, too, but I'm killing the monk because you know what? He didn't do anything when they fucked their shop up. Like, that's still fucked up. That's, you know, he was complicit. He was also complicit when he watched Andrew McCarthy get his ass beat.
That's true.
So, you know what?
He was like, hey, maybe I should leave.
Yeah.
That's all he said.
He deserves to die, and I hope he burns in hell.
Joel Schumacher.
So, question number two. If you were to remake St. Elmo's Fire, what chain restaurant would you set it in? And who is the modern brat pack who's working at this chain restaurant?
I would do Fuddruckers.
Really?
I would do...
build your own burger?
No, I do. No, Red Robin.
Robin?
I would do Red Robin.
Do those exist anymore?
They're mostly closed. But we are getting a Raising Cane's where Red Robin used to be down the road, which I'm very excited for.
Raising Cane's sucks, dude.
You need to back the fuck up.
It's just bland white boy chicken. What's wrong with you?
I mean, I like Popeyes. I like Popeyes more.
There's no fucking spice to Cane's. You know, Cane's comeback sauce, pretty good.
Yeah.
The rest, dog shit.
It's all about the sauce.
Nah,
Popeyes, the chicken is good, but the rice and beans, the red rice and beans is where it's at.
I love Popeyes. And I like their tenders, too.
Of course, the biscuits.
Well, and also, if I'm eating any kind of fried chicken, I want it to be spicy. That's why I like the Nashville hot places. The Hattie B's that just moved in. Ooh, that motherfucker burned my butthole so bad.
I said the hot ones.
You still
got
a Tumble 22 ever?
Did you?
Yeah, I had to bomb and... I had a weird Monday.
Yeah, how did the bomb go on the way out?
Did it live up to its name?
I've had it three times. That's the third time I've done it, and it doesn't get any easier.
When I was staying at Cody's house and watching it while he was in Japan, I found his stash of hot sauces, I was putting the bomb in my eggs every morning.
Dang, that's brave.
And I tell you what, them eggs tasted good.
It only takes a drop.
I was throwing, you know what? It only takes a drop if you're weak. But if you're a real man... Or if you're a sadistic monk, you're throwing some dashes in there, not just a drop. Live your life.
It's going Morse code in that bitch.
Yeah.
But I need to say the actors too, right? Who are going to be at Red Robin?
Yeah, that's the question, motherfucker.
So I would put Austin Butler in there.
Yep.
What role is he playing? He's Rob Lowe. Yeah, yeah. He's
got
to be Rob Lowe.
He's got to be beautiful. And then...
Wait, so he's playing a saxophone in the middle of Red Robin?
Yeah, well, he was playing a saxophone in the middle of fucking St. Elmo. Like, what?
But, I mean, that was more
why
of a
was that
bar.
A thing that was
just
happening?
A bar. It's not a chain bar. It's just a bar.
I know, but we gotta account. Like, what if he's playing it in the middle of a Pluckers? Or an Olive Garden?
I'm
endless breadsticks and saxophone.
No. I have a new one. I'm doing Red Lobster.
Endless sticks and sex.
It's at Red Lobster.
And endless shrimp.
And the whole thing centers around how busy Emilio Estevez's character.
Bankruptcy and bad music.
Yes. I would do, yeah, so Austin Butler is Rob Lowe.
Okay, that's a good pick. I like that.
Yeah.
He's a better actor than Rob Lowe.
A lot better. And I like Rob Lowe. You ever seen Youngblood?
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, we'll get into that next week.
With Pete Swayze.
Ooh, hockey, baby.
And then I would do, stick in fucking Dune Land, get Tim Schall in there. Yeah.
Who's T. Schall's playing?
I think
Judd.
Ooh, that's
yeah,
not bad.
I think so. Slicked back hair.
Yeah, the yuppie. Mm-hmm. He could do the American Psycho thing.
He could get real douchey with it, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Because he's kind of would just play the grown up version of his Lady Bird character, though.
Yeah.
Once he stops smoking cloves and, starts trading stocks and gets eventually thrown into jail for embezzlement.
And then I would just have Zendaya play Ally Sheedy. Have them be a couple again.
I'd push back and I'd say have her do Demi Moore because Zendaya's already gone the whole Euphoria route. Like she can be a junkie.
I don't want to see her do that again, though.
I don't see the Ally Sheedy role, though. I don't think she works there because, like, Challengers, she's really duplicitous and, like, she's the most interesting part of that movie because she's almost playing with chess pieces.
So is she Rob Lowe's girlfriend then?
Well, that's not a bad call.
But she has to be believably frumpy.
Yeah.
I don't see her ever having body dysmorphia.
Yeah, maybe no Zendaya at all.
I know that we're probably losing some box office in doing this, but I'm not hiring Zendaya.
I'm trying to think of other... We were talking about Jeremy Allen White, but I think he's strangely just wouldn't match the energy.
He could be Estevez.
No. Because the thing is that we don't have a unified... Thing that you're gonna talk
set
about,
of movie stars.
Yeah, we talked about that in the doc, they talked about too, is like without the internet, it was a lot easier for these things to kind of take hold, because it wasn't the internet. It's basically made everything so separated. Right.
So you've got T. Schall's, you've got Austin Butler. Who's Glenn Powell? Is Glenn Powell the Andrew McCarthy character?
No,
is he too pretty?
He could be Emilio.
Amelia?
And they make that story more, less,
less stalkerish?
Yeah.
Yeah, when he goes and basically forces Andy McDowell to kiss him. Rough scene.
Yep.
Rough beat for Andy McDowell, too. Oof.
And then, it's funny, because I'm just trying to think of other, young, Sydney Sweeney could honestly do, I'd see her doing the Demi Moore role, because she's similarly, as a star, that's ridiculously hot. Like, that's kind of her star image.
Sydney Sweeney. Oh, Sydney Sweeney would be perfect in the Demi Moore role. Good call on that one.
Yeah.
What about Jacob Elordi in one of these? Like, could he do...
He could actually do Judd as well.
Yeah.
I was going to say make him the Andrew McCarthy role where he's like... he's almost coded as sexually ambiguous a little bit.
I just don't buy... I think his star image is he's too sexy. Like, Andrew McCarthy, I like... And this because it's like he's good looking, but it's not so like if it's almost like having Rob Lowe play that part. You're like, whoa, no, I wouldn't. I'm trying to think of anyone who has
Tom Holland could be Emilio.
Tom Holland's not a bad call, but he sucks outside of Spider-Man movies.
He's just not a very good actor.
Has he made a good movie outside of those films? I don't think so.
What was the
Cherry was bad.
What was the Saints one? Something Saints.
What happened to that ginger from Manchester by the Sea? What the fuck's he doing these days?
Oh, yeah, the kid.
Oh, Lucas Hodges?
Lucas Hedges?
Hodges, right?
Hedges.
Hedges? Yeah.
Crying at the chicken in the freezer?
Yeah. He could do the Andrew McCarthy role.
He's a little... Oh.
He might be a touch old.
Yeah, I think he's a little old now.
But is he? No.
Oh, Joey King, I like her.
For the
Ally Sheedy part.
Ally Sheedy role. That's not bad.
I think you could put Maya Hawke in the...
Ooh. That's
Rob Lowe's girlfriend.
That's really good, too.
Yeah, she'd be great.
Yeah. So you got Maya Hawke, Sydney Sweeney.
Oh, Joey King.
Joey King. And then we got Chalamet, Austin Butler.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, 10 years ago would be
good.
Yeah,
he's got a fat head now.
Yeah.
He looks weird in Beverly Hills Cop.
He's got a big old fat head. It's weird.
Yeah, chin strap beard.
Yeah. His eyes look like they got closer together somehow.
Wow, what a really uninteresting top 100 on...
Paul Walter Hauser. What about Paul Walter Hauser? Does he fit any of the roles?
Oh, my God. Dude, no.
What about the guy that plays Steve Harrington on Stranger Things? He could be the the McCarthy character.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
And he kind of fits that class.
Yeah.
Well, do Paul Walter Hauser then for Emilio?
You think so? Walter Hauser as Emilio?
Yeah, I do think it's like...
You don't think he's too old? He was Richard Jewell.
I mean, he's definitely too old, but like likable. But he plays the same part in Cobra Kai, where he's the old guy who just kind of hangs around.
That'd be really funny. This is kind of a great lesson in that we just don't have many young movie stars.
No, seriously, no. I literally looked on IMDb, and it's all like older stars that still have clout, which is great. But it's just not those young, like, exciting people.
Who does Oscar Isaac play? He's 40.
No, he plays the guy who's sleeping with Andy McDowell.
What about Chris Pratt?
Who plays Andy McDowell? There's the Zendaya role.
No, she's got to be older.
Do you think they have a role for a CGI raccoon?
That'd be funny. Chris Pratt plays every role. It's like the clumps. it's in our new AI world.
Directed by Bradley Cooper.
It's all just like computer generated, and he just voices them all.
What if it's just... St. Elmo's Fire, but it takes place in a Long John Silver's, and all of the characters are dolphins generated by AI.
I mean, you can plug that into AI and actually get a result.
And they're all voiced by Michael Shannon.
I would watch that.
You know what? Now we're cooking with gas now. All right, next question.
Ooga booga, ooga booga, ah, ah, ah.
Over under on the amount of gay slurs Kevin Dillon uses in Heaven Help Us. Did anybody, should we have like a homophobia tally in that movie? Because it's bad.
I mean, he says it.
He drops three in the closing voiceover.
Yeah, the sweet like, hey, thanks for coming to our movie. Here's some hate speech to see you out of the theater.
I'm a shampoo boy now around a lot of homos.
He says they're funny at that point. He kind of is nicer. I would say 20 times he says it.
It's bad.
At least.
It's the harshest part of the movie. And that, like, because I remembered it because Comedy Central either didn't bleep all of them out or just left them in and they weren't as.
Well, they didn't
think
they
were
bad
more than
then.
I remembered. But, like, rewatching it, like, it's almost every other word with him. But it also kind of. So I have a dual kind of take on this, and a lot of people are going to fucking hate this if they're infected by the woke mind virus, but...
I finally got Jacob onto Breitbart. Yeah. He's finally...
I just made my 4chan login the other day.
So welcome, brother.
But it is like the coarseness of his language and the homophobia of it almost helps establish the tone in a real way and roots it in a very specific time and place. And he's also, everybody knew that guy in high school who only had one insult. And his insult just happens to be the grossest word you can call another dude.
Well, and it's also like, they even say it in the movie though, like the other, the Caesar character says, he obviously has repressed homosexuality. He's saying it so much.
Yeah.
Like they even comment on it.
Because he is just a caveman completely.
Yeah, exactly.
So who directs, we kind of teased that Tarantino had been talking about doing a Less Than Zero remake for a while. Who would we actually want to see direct a Less Than Zero remake?
The Safdie brothers.
I mean, that's really good.
You just take, Good Time and then plug that aesthetic onto this.
I mean, that's pretty good. Sean Baker is the other one that I think would be interesting because I think he would have empathy for the addicts and drug dealers and, you know, eventual sex workers and everything. I think he would put maybe more of a very human spin on the story.
I think Luca would be interesting.
Well, Luca was supposed to adapt The Shards
for
an HBO series, and he just dropped out. Like, I would kill. I'm so mad that he's not doing that. Have you read The Shards yet?
I'm going to borrow your copy for my trip.
The Shards fucking rules, man. It's this giant. It's almost like Bret Easton Ellis's It, in that he writes it in this really weird way, in that it's a Less Than Zero prequel. It's basically the middle school or like junior high years before you get into you know, the high school milieu that he, that Clay kind of graduates from.
So it's the same characters. It's a direct prequel.
It references the characters, but it's a new set, but it's about how it's all set in this, this upper class California, Los Angeles world. You know, and it's written almost like a direct memoir, like it's Bret Easton Ellis recollecting or recounting his own kind of memories and like almost like confessing to the worst thing that ever happened in his life and this like deep, dark secret that he's lived with. And then how they all have to basically go back to try and like figure out and stop this evil, a lot like it, you know, like something happened in their past and now as adults they're reckoning with it. Only in his past it's a fucking serial killer called the Trawler who cuts people open and puts like bags of fish in their stomach and shit.
Jesus.
The book fucking rules.
But he, I mean, again, he'd be perfect for Less Than Zero because too, like, you think about Challengers and how a good element of that is these people who are, especially two of them, very wealthy, looking for some sort of meaning, right?
Yeah. Right.
It's like, well, we kind of have everything we need, but it's like finding that reason of like competition, you know, and keeping that alive and like, oh, we could just, honestly, we could just quit and be rich. Like, we're fine.
Well, and that sexual fluidity too. Absolutely. Of, like, Luca's movies, because like I just rewatched it Monday with Carrie and like.
So fucking good.
She literally looked at me like 30 minutes in and was like, all right, so when are these two going to bang? And I'm like, yeah, you kind of narrowed it
kinda,
down.
Kind of the point.
That's what the movie is. But yeah, it's.
And then you get a POV shot from the condom that Downey's wearing every time he has to do a sexual act.
Oh, God.
That's not a bad idea.
But like, Luca would fucking rock too. So yeah. I would watch all three of those.
Or if you want to go like full drone core, Refn. And just go lean in. But it'd be. I mean,
too much.
It would not have the emotional core at all.
He, you know? He might actually, now that I'm thinking about it, he might be great at it though, because he would at least get that alien remove that like Ellis's novels
Neon
capture.
Demon in particular. I mean, it's obviously
very
too
LA.
Old to die young, but the LA kind of hellscape of like, well, she's made it and it's this fairy tale world, but like
it's all rapists.
It's just
predators.
Horrible people who want to kill her. So
what was your question? You said that you had a secret question you wanted to spring on us as the last one.
I was going to say, okay, so I think when we go forward in this series, like we were saying, one of the things we're going to notice is that these things are not going to fly today.
Right.
Right. So the most egregious part of St. Elmo's Fire, as we mentioned, is the stalking of Andy McDowell by Emilio Estevez. He's the weirdest side plot. It's his whole plot. He's like, I like her, and I'm going to make her mine.
I'm going to law school, and also I have to have this doctor lady.
If you changed musical cues,
yeah,
like
put some droning stuff in
it
there,
it would go from being a weird, almost like rom-com subplot to being like a straight-up serial killer movie.
Well,
he's like watching her on dates through in the rain, like through a window at a restaurant, and like
put some Manhunter music to it.
Yeah, if you threw something on like that, yeah, he basically is someone that Will Graham is hunting. It's pretty gnarly.
Well, that's my question though: is how, if this film were made today, how would you update that update that plot point, or what would be a really satisfying way to end that plot point even back in the 80s that's not so horrific?
I think actually you follow it all the way through is that he gets murdered by her boyfriend.
He shoots him when
he shows up to the cabin,
yeah.
And like he starts acting like an asshole, and like instead of having this weird, like, he drives off after forcing her to kiss him, and it's, like, supposed to be played as this big moment of triumph, and you're like, this is fucking weird, man. Like, he just shows up, or, like, maybe he grabs her, and the boyfriend just fucking blows his head off, and you're like, well, that's the end of Emilio's storyline.
I was thinking, literally, we build it up almost like a horror scene, like you were saying, and he's trying to get into the cabin, and it's this whole thing, and he finally gets the door open, and just two barrels... Right, and he just like flies back into the snow,
Charles Bronson, like
that's
death
like
hunt.
Uma Thurman in Kill Bill 2.
Exactly, just boom, you know.
And then smash cut, you're at his funeral, and all of his friends are dressed in black, just standing around the coffin. Like, we always kind of knew.
Roblo's playing
this way.
The sax at his funeral,
and then they're walking away, and that's when Ali Sheedy's like, "Guys, I can't love you both. I think I need to be alone for a while."
Yep. And then you just cue that crazy song that was like the theme song
of the movie.
John Parr.
Yeah.
That's just good shit. Man in motion.
God.
The whole cast had to be in the music video. That's how wild things were.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like it straight up sounds like it's supposed to be for like a Rocky training montage.
Well, he did the end song for Running Man.
Oh.
This is no game.
Yeah, everybody was trying to be Frank Stallone, man. It's fucking weird. Well, guys, this has been great.
Indeed.
So what are we doing? What are we doing next?
Emilio!
The
Mighty Duckman himself, I swear to God.
We're going to do Repo Man, Wisdom, and then Young Guns.
That's good shit.
All three. Repo Man and Young Guns. Repo Man is an all-timer, maybe top 10 classic.
First time I saw that was with you.
Young Guns, quite good too. Wisdom, never actually seen, so I'm excited.
It's a real movie, though. We'll find out.
It's a real movie that you can watch with your eyes and listen to with your ears.
Which may or may not just be about teeth. We don't know.
But you have to find out how we feel about it next time on Secret Handshake. See ya.
Bye.
Stop and remember.